Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horlick with my co-host, Scott Hoag. Tom Coffeen is out today. And we're going to be talking about blockers to IPv6 adoption. And we have our guest, Dr. David Holder from Aireon. And we want to jump in and talk about all sorts of objections that folks have about IPv6. But David, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, we're excited to chat. It's been a little while for us getting a chance to talk, but I had seen your presentation at the UK IPv6 Council, and you had recently done a presentation about some of the blockers around or objections that people have around adopting IPv6, and we were chatting. We were just like, wow, this would be a great one to have on the show. So what are the things? What are the things that sort of come up over and over, you know, for you around people sort of arguing with you around adopting IPv6?
Well, Ed, there are three big ones. I guess you guys have come across this all the time as well. And the first one, which tends to come from business people, but also sometimes from technical people, is why bother fixing something that isn't broken? So their view is, we have an IPv4 internet. It's working. It's doing everything that we need. We've got our applications. Everything's good. So why invest time and money in deploying IPv6 when what we're deploying is the internet? It's what we've already got. So that sometimes is number one. The other one that's really close to that, is coupled to that, is we have no budget for IPv6. Okay. And we hear that a lot from very frustrated IT people who believe in IPv6, but they say, we just cannot get budget. So the two are linked.
Now, is that discussion really more around the fact that they don't have a discrete budget for IPv6 versus just like, we don't have an IT budget, period?
Sometimes it's both, but sometimes it's, we don't have a discrete budget for IPv6.
Got it.
Well, and they don't have a budget because they've failed to tie benefits of IPv6 to their business. They haven't made a business case for it. They haven't gone to ask for money. So yes, there's no money because they haven't asked for it and they don't understand. I mean, so that's part of it. That's why there's no budget for that as a Absolutely. Project, because it's never been sent up the flagpole to ask.
And I think, Scott, that even when they have tried to justify IPv6, I've come across times when people have done an excellent job of saying, this is why you need V6, this is why we need V6, and this is why the fact that we have IPv4 isn't sufficient and will not be sufficient in the future, and they still don't get a budget. And so it's not just that they haven't justified it, but it's partly that.
All right. And what's number three?
Well, number three, and sometimes this one comes first, it depends on the type of person you're speaking to. This is, we lose the benefits of NAT4.4. So these are generally technical people who believe that network address translation is a crucial part of their network topology or infrastructure, or provides a crucial service such as multi-homing, and they cannot see how we get that with IPv6. So the two things are, sometimes it's multi-homing they're concerned about, and sometimes it's the security that they perceive that they get from network address translation.
Well, all I can say is, Scott, thank you for muting your microphone, for keeping the sobbing down.
So these kind of, you know, they sound like excuses. So someone who doesn't want to do but the minimum at work and wants to get paid to do the very least amount of effort, they might come up with excuses or foot drag, or, you know, avoid, or purposefully, you know, derail an IPv6 project. You know, that they could be using these excuses in that way, in a negative way.
That's certainly true sometimes, but I think there's a lot of times when the people genuinely believe these things. And some people who've argued these things, I wouldn't describe them as slackers or trying to avoid work. They do genuinely believe these things. So I don't think it's as simple as that. But yes, there are times, you're absolutely right, when they are simply excuses. And the problem we have is that at a superficial level, they're believable. Or at least two of them are. It's so at a superficial level. So, you know, from a business perspective, from a non-technical person's perspective, the V4 internet and the V6 internet look like the same thing that they're paying for.
Right.
And they've already got one. So why pay to duplicate it? And I think we've actually done ourselves some harm in bringing ourselves to this position because of historic mistakes we have made in presenting IPv6. So you guys will well remember 15, 20 years ago, people were very keen on saying, we will drop off the end of a cliff. The world will end when we run out of addresses. You know,
yes.
And it didn't.
And it still hasn't. It still hasn't.
And it still hasn't. And we know that the reason that has happened is because a huge amount of effort, both in time and money, has been put into keeping the V4 internet going, because nobody could afford to see it just fail and to drop off the end of a cliff. So what the business leaders don't see is that effort that's gone in, because most of it has gone into operating system developers, improving NAT and NAT traversal, equipment manufacturers and suppliers, service providers, deploying new ways of conserving addresses, including IPv6, ironically, but also things like carrier-grade NAT. So from a business perspective, they look at it, they do not see the enormous amount of money and effort that has gone into keeping the V4 internet functioning. But what they also don't see is that increased complexity is leading to what I would call a deterioration of the V4 internet.
Yeah.
And so that the fundamental flaw in their argument and where they go wrong is that they believe the two things are the same. And what we're actually seeing is a downgrade of V4 as it gradually gets worse, despite all of the efforts, whereas V6 is a thing of beauty and purity.
Well, I mean, I think it's fantastic points, and I definitely agree. And I think, you know, from a pure business standpoint, they might look at it and say, well, those are sunk capital costs in terms of investments to keep the existing V4 internet operational. And you can't really, I don't think you could argue that's a true statement in terms of what benefit they've gained out of it. But I do agree tremendously that the lack of understanding of the fact that, you know, the internet is a far more complex, you know, obviously, network than what many common lay people and business people probably think it actually is. And not having that nuanced understanding probably causes a tremendous amount of grief between the technical community and the business folks in terms of understanding where investments need to be made and where that budget needs to be spent. Cause that's a very hard conversation to have, because it puts the technical people in an awkward situation. And Scott and I have talked about this quite a bit, of saying like, hey, you should dump more money into getting something that operationally looks no different than what you're running today. And how do you have that conversation in a way that sort of demonstrates that they get something demonstrably better? And there's sort of two facets to do that. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later, but you know, do you really feel like most of these arguments are sort of credible? And how do you answer back? Like you sat down and had these first set of conversations of like, hey, why are we fixing something that isn't really broken? We got no budget. And we, you know, what's, you know, we think NAT 4.4 is the best thing since sliced bread. You know, how do you answer back when you're sitting across the table? Cause you've done this tons of times. Like, what are those answers that are commonly seem to make the most sense and resonate and allow you to sort of move a project forward and help customers to sort of, you know, get there as it would be?
Yeah. Well, I think that the first thing to start with is who you're talking to. if you're talking to business people, we need to be using business arguments. The technical arguments, it's exactly as you said, Ed. We have a real problem because the criticism of deploying IPv6, why fix something that isn't broken, is a simple statement to make. But the response is actually technical and horrendously complicated underneath. And so what we need to do before anything else is, if they're business people that we're talking to, we need to use terminology that has a resonance with them, that means something to them as business people. It has an impact on their business. It's terminology that they're used to, that it's core to what they do and to managing the business. So when we talk about the IPv4 internet deteriorating, we need to choose out of that the areas where it's deteriorating that are demonstrably true. That kind of helps, but also that they can be couched in business terms. So to give you an example or two, maybe, one of the areas that I absolutely love to bits because it does an enormous amount of benefit as advocates of IPv6 is carrier grade NAT. I think you guys know I'm a great fan of carrier grade NAT. Now, there is no way in the world that explaining the intricacies of CGN to a business person is going to work. They will turn off at the first two words of carrier grade, probably. But the impacts that CGN has on business processes, such as web analytics, legal intercept, security, forensics, good governance, reliability, and performance, something over which, because CGN is in the internet today, particularly in mobile networks, but also in fixed networks, and you have no control over where it is, it can have an impact on what you are doing as a business and what you are delivering to end users, to your employees who are working remotely, to your partners that you're working with over the internet. It can impact all of these, and you have no control over where that impact is. And so business leaders understand the need for analytics in IT. They understand the need to have something that performs well with their customers. They understand even things like if they have a business iPhone app, which is extremely common today, they understand that they don't want to drain the battery on their users' iPhones. Whereas we know that CGN, through the fact that it needs to keep state, requires keep-alives over IPv4, whereas IPv6 does not require keep-alives. And those keep-alives are extremely expensive in terms of battery power. So this is an argument that, as long as you don't go too much into the technical aspects of it, has a real resonance with business leaders, mm-hmm. with those making decisions.
Yeah, along those lines, if you're an online retailer and you use those web analytics to say who's coming to my site, you know, you're capturing either on your load balancer the client IP address, or you think you've got a client IP address, and you might on your load balancer stick it in your X forwarded VOR header and hand it back to your app tier. Well, that V4 address that you get is really coming from a pool of addresses on that carrier grade NAT mm-hmm. system. It's not the real client IP. And so online retailers use the client IP to perform things like fraud detection. They're looking for fraudulent purchases with fake credit cards. And, you know, and we've all gone to our bank and our bank says, you're coming from a different computer than you came from yesterday, and I'm going to ask you your secret questions. If you're going through carrier grade NAT, you're going to get asked the secret questions a lot more frequently, and because your bank is struggling with how to keep, you know, knowledge of you and who you are and where you're at, and retailers are trying to do the same thing. You know, keep track of customers. Where are they buying from? Who are the bad guys? buying bad product or not paying for it or fake credit cards, and you're trying to do that with address, and that's all you have. If all you have is a V4 address because your website is V4 only, then you only have one level of information.
Mm.
Yeah. I think to David's point too, around the business side, what I think is resonant for a lot of people is, do you want to be that company? Do you want to be the company? Like, how angry would you be if you found out that because of the performance of your product, your app in the iPhone store, that you drain people's batteries that much faster? I think you got called out on like Reddit or something. The reputation to your business, the impact to your business is you were just too lazy to adopt IPv6 at the edge to provide services, you know, and be able to run your service that way and bypass the CGN problem entirely, because that's one of the benefits you get out of IPv6 is, at least here in the US, and I'm sure for many of the mobile operators in Europe, you know, IPv6 is just there and available, and it's native. You're going to get it right away. And so if your application can use V6, you will bypass all the carrier grade NAT installation work that all the major providers have done, because you don't need it. V6 just works naturally, and you will save battery life for these sort of things. And there's all sorts of other interesting use cases around mobile gaming and I think other areas. And I think the mobile gaming market really sort of understands some of the advantages around IPv6 in general. But for this, it's great points. I mean, talking business language around performance, around reputation, around reliability, around the fact that you want some sort of analytics, as Scott mentioned, you know, it's those are all super important things. And then the governance and security and audit around legal, I think in Europe, you folks are doing a lot more in that space than we are here in the U.S., at least currently. And who knows? The pendulum may swing the other way. But the lawful intercept side becomes, in terms of granularity, it becomes a lot more useful on the IPv6 side than maybe on the V4 side, where we're allowing a lot of people to hide behind, you know, NAT on NAT on NAT on NAT, you know, just turtles the whole way down. In terms of obscuring away identity and information to be able to do stuff. And there's still ways to be able to be anonymous on the internet. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's other ways to do a lot of jump points and anonymous sort of facilities. But at least from a transaction basis, from V6, you can at least know who you're talking to on the other end from that side. So I think your points are right on. I think it's important for people to understand when you're speaking to that business audience. And you've done this a ton, and I've seen your presentations. You do a fantastic job just sort of walking people through, like, speak the language of the audience, right? Making sure that you're really addressing it for them. What about for the technical folks that are coming back to you and they're like, you know, NAT4.4 is the best thing ever, and, you know, switching gears from the business side to the technical side? How do those discussions go? Because clearly they've got a different set of arguments about what they want to see and what advantages they think they've got. Is it also sort of the carrier grade NAT problem? I mean, how do you move them past some of those conversations?
You're right. It's still the carrier grade NAT problem, along with performance and other things. But at least we can talk about it in detail, and we can talk about fragmentation of the routing tables in IPv4 and how address exhaustion is making that much worse. So if you look at the V4 world, we've got a million routes. If we look at the V6 world, we've only got 100,000 routes in the routing tables. We've got a lot more that we can talk about, which they will understand that there are performance resource issues related to those things. So that's good. But when you come to actually specifically talking about NAT, you have two main classes of people that you're talking to. Those who understand that and have experienced it in large enterprises. And if you come across people who manage large-scale NAT, CGN in large enterprises, they hate it with a passion. They loathe it. And the reason they loathe it is because they know intimately all the problems that it's causing them from a management perspective. And then a knock-on effect is having business implications. So these are people that you don't have to persuade at all. But where you do have to persuade people is the people who are in much more, usually smaller, but not always, simpler environments, where the pain of gnat is less obvious to them. So and then you've got the two categories of whether those people are talking about security with gnat or whether they're talking about multi-homing. So the security fits into the category of arguments that are not credible, but the multi-homing one does have some credibility. So to deal with the security one first, I always like to tell them about my friend Phil. And I know I've told you guys about Phil. So when we were building a house up here in Scotland, many years ago now, the front door wouldn't open, which is extremely frustrating. It was broken. And my friend, who's a gnat believer, Phil, he said to me, David, that's great. That's absolutely fantastic because you now have a secure house. And I looked at Phil and I said, you know, that Phil, that does not make sense. I actually want to get into my house. He said, David, not a problem. On the first floor over there, you have a window slightly open. You're a rock climber. You've got a ladder and some ropes. You can get through that window. And so this is very, very typical gnat thinking, that gnat brings security, because gnat breaks the end-to-end connectivity. And that does provide a measure of security in that it breaks inbound connections. It makes inbound connections very hard, whereas outbound connections are what gnat is designed for. So in a sense, you get a form of security, but alongside that, you get all of the brokenness. And what a lot of gnat believers fail to remember is that you can get the same level of security as gnat or apparent security simply by using a firewall, but you have the option of using the end-to-end connectivity if you're using a firewall rather than gnat. So that particular problem, the security problem, is a, I don't know if you call this in the US, a red herring.
Yes, yeah.
It's a red herring. And if you're dealing with a true gnat believer, it can be very difficult to reason. There's only so far you can go.
that story just resonates for me. It's basically like it's funny. It's I get additional exercise for mountain climbing every single day. In order to get in and out of my house is just hysterical. It's like get extra exercise. Maybe it's better for your health. I don't know. I agree with you entirely. My arguments around gnat are much more about the fact that for larger scale enterprises, besides the carry grade gnat folks, there's sort of a mid-tier folks that go through a lot of mergers and acquisitions or go through a lot of divestitures, and they start introducing gnat inside their own internal network and they break all their routing. And the great thing about having discussions with those folks is like, please, I just want to go back to routing as routing. I want to get rid of all this state all over my network. I want to get rid of all this, you know, locations where I have to be very particular about how we're doing routing to NAT translation related work and make sure we don't have asymmetrical routing. It's like, if we just have routing, we don't have to worry about any of that. And that's one of the beauties that you get by eliminating NAT, even within your own internal network, is that you get to just use routing protocols as routing protocols again, you know, and have that full visibility end to end of I attach a network segment and it just enters the routing table and it's available that way and life is good. And I think, you know, restoring that sort of end to end is maybe an altruistic vision for V6 in terms of the end to end internet aspect, because I still believe there's a portion of security. But at no point did anyone in the IPv6 community, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, ever say that just because you're using global unicast addresses, do you have to make them available to everyone on the IPv6 internet? In other words, if there's a portion of the address space that you want to utilize that's only for your internal use and only for security reasons, and you don't ever really want it to go out to the public internet for any given reason, you can actually take a portion of your global unicast address space and just not allow it to route out to the public internet. It's perfectly feasible to do that. You just don't introduce it from the routing table basis and you don't forward and life is good. So it actually, you get many of the similar functions of what you can quote unquote provide via NAT in the exact same way. So
yeah, and the other thing they forget, Ed, which amuses me no end, is that NAT isn't secure. And you only have to look over recent years for some of the horrendous things that have happened with insecure NAT traversal techniques. And NAT itself, because of all the complexity, because of all the state, and because of some of the NAT traversal techniques that are burnt in as standard into most NAT boxes, such as universal plug and play and others, there are significant security issues, particularly denial of service, but others as well, with all of these NAT implementations.
Yeah, and that's the brittleness that we've introduced into IPv4, because we basically were trying to conserve host-based addresses. You know, we needed to share it. We have to share all these resources because we don't have enough, and which is gets back to the fundamental argument about why V6, right? We've got plenty. You don't worry about that side of it, right? We'll hand you as many as you want. But in V4 world, we have to be like, yeah, we have to hold on to this stuff. We have to conserve it. We have to be very careful. We have to share it as a resource. We have to hide behind a single global address because it's the only thing that's available for, you know, this site location. We don't have those visibility. So all those arguments definitely hold true. And I think anyone who deals with NAT on a regular basis in an intimate way, as opposed to the, sort of the set it, forget it, maybe at a home network, which is, you know, maybe where executives sort of see it. They get enough experience out of just setting up maybe their home Comcast configuration or something like that to be like, oh, well, you know, all my family is hidden behind this one IP address. I sort of get that. But the reality is that for anyone who's managing at a scale, you're exactly correct, dealing with large-scale service providers and for larger enterprises that are dealing with carrier-grade NAT and large-scale NAT 4.4 or 4.4.4 implementations, they just hate it. They loathe it. And they would love to just be getting back to the good old days of routing. Well, let's switch gears. Let's talk about the multi-homing problem, because you brought that up around sort of the NAT advantages around multi-homing. What's the arguments around those?
Well, the problem with multi-homing is that people have gotten used, because they had NAT, it allows people to use NAT to multi-home even when they don't have PI space, provider independent space. So when they don't have their own address space, which they are advertising using BGP to multiple peers, they can go to multiple ISPs, use the ISP's IPv4 addresses, but they can map it to their private address space and thereby get resilience and load balancing through two different ISPs, without having to go to the additional complexity and cost of running BGP and getting private independent space, PI space. That is a use case which is a problem, because it's so incredibly simple to use NAT to solve the multi-homing problem with PA space, provider aggregatable space from ISPs. And there isn't, at the moment, a solution for every particular use case of multi-homing that we have in IPv4. So that's a problem. If you're an organization and you've got PI space with IPv4 and you deploy V6, you will probably get PI space with V6. It's not a problem. If you're one of the huge number of organizations that don't multi-home, it's not a problem. And if you're in certain subsets of multi-homing with multiple ISPs without having PI space, you can still be okay. But there is a subset of scenarios where customers use NAT to solve a problem where there isn't yet a standard-based solution for IPv6.
Right. And that's really probably very common for businesses that are in that mid-size space category, right, where they're getting two different internet connections from two different local service providers, and maybe they're using one as a failover, and they just don't want to have to reprovision their firewall in a complex way, so they just sort of flip things back and forth. And so the only thing that's really changing is maybe their public front-facing IPv4 global IPv4 address, and they're just doing a little bit of detection to make sure they're upstream gateways available, and like when they see their primary one isn't available on service provider A, they flip over to service provider B and it runs there until they test the other one, then it flops back and forth. And it sort of keeps them up and available on the internet, but it's using just the provider allocated address space from each one of those providers. It doesn't actually, you're not using your own independent, you know, address space is sort of the, I sort of see that in it's sort of common. Maybe it's like branch office sort of configurations where they're trying to get back to VPN, back to the corporate office, and they want to have something available, things like that. And I agree with you. They run into that space. I would say in V6, you know, if your bigger corporate environment is doing things correctly and they have PI space, they're just going to allocate those smaller locations PI space and advertise it appropriately and solve that.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And I think this is actually something I was going to say, is that there is a big danger in all of this, in all of the decisions that we make with V6, is of the IPv4 mindset influencing how we look at it.
Couldn't agree more.
And so we think, we've got this topology, we've got this solution, we've got this way of working, which is V4, or we have this particular set of equipment in place that's V4. Therefore, we need to shoehorn our IPv6 solution into the same way of doing things.
Been through that conversation many times.
There are a whole host of organizations, not all. I mean, I'd love to say everybody should go and get PI space. But so there are a whole host of organizations that don't have PI space now for V4, where it would be sensible for them to have PI space for V6.
And there's plenty available. I mean, that's the other thing, is that there's
That's the beauty of V6. This is less of a problem than it was in the V4 world. There's still a cost, there's still an administrative overhead, but some of the difficulties can sometimes be passed to third parties, so your ISP can handle this for you. And I think that people need to be aware that when they're approaching problems like this, they might need to change their solution. And it's really, really hard to do this because everybody has been brainwashed into thinking the V4 way. And then you come to deploy in V6, and the natural thing to do is, this works in V4, let's try and do the equivalent in V6. Whereas in V6, sometimes the exact opposite of what you do in V4 is the right thing to do in V6.
Right.
And so we need to question, one of the things that we encourage clients to do is to question absolutely everything they do. Because quite often they built up these wonderful topologies and networks and edge services, and there's a better way with V6. And I've actually been in organizations, which I will not name, that would not be fair, where I've seen the look of horror on their faces as they realize that this thing of complexity that they built up to solve this particular problem in IPv4 is completely unrequired with IPv6. And so they can see, that's a big part of my job. And with V6, we don't need it.
That just frees you up to do other interesting work, though. So I don't think that's a downside. Go work on automation. Go work on public cloud. There's lots of other things that you can work on.
Oh, absolutely. In cybersecurity, that's an endless job security area.
Let's pivot a little bit, because I think that's a fantastic point in regards to what we commonly refer to as V4 thinking. We say it's the V4 think or the V4 thinking issue for many organizations. What are those mind barrier sort of blockers, and how do you take the blinders off of people to be like, hey, how do you see the light around IPv6, and how do you really sort of get them there? How do you walk them through that journey to get them step by step and through that?
The answer needs to be tailored to the client, as I said before. There's such a huge variation in people that you meet in IT and their level of perception of IPv6. But the one big thing that we have found again and again and again is that the awareness and training is absolutely key to the success of an IPv6 deployment. I think everybody says this. And one of the things that I probably heard more than anything else from IT professionals is, we had no idea that IPv6 was this different from V4. And their realization that there's a whole world that they hadn't appreciated or understood was there. So education is absolutely key for this. And we need to be, when we're working with organizations, one of the things that is absolutely essential is looking for those people who will be our allies. And the key people who will become enthusiastic about IPv6, who will appreciate it and work with us to help us bring about a change of mindset within the organization. But there is one thing I'd like to go back to, though, and sure. just mention. And that is, you know, we mentioned budgeting and the issue of budgeting. There is an impediment deploying IPv6, which is a fear of the fact that this is a big project to do. Because we all know that deploying IPv6 and doing it properly and doing best practice, there are a whole host of things that if you are being wise and if you are being prudent, if you're being sensible, you should do them as a deployment project. You should have an IPv6 strategy. You should do it with great care. But the flip side of that truth is that people think, oh, this is a monster. They see it that we have to plan every little bit of our IPv6 deployment. Everything has to be done at once. This is just an insurmountable mountain to climb. And that actually is something that isn't true, because there's so much that can be done regardless of whether we have actually got to the point where we've got funding for a big IPv6 deployment or not. And some of those things are free. They're zero cost. For example, really obvious ones. Any prudent business today should have a policy that says everything we purchase is V6 enabled. But not only that, everything we develop in software or applications should be V6 ready. Because there is no excuse today for rolling out software or equipment or developing new software and applications that is not V6 ready. That is just a waste of money, that you will have to redo all of that. But also employ people who've got V6 skills. So if in your recruitment, don't be employing people that you later have to train to do V6. Employ them with the skills at the start. So there is two sides to that. One is, yep, you do need to have a strategy and a big project to deploy IPv6. Big is possibly not the right word, but a coordinated movement to deploy IPv6 is wise and sensible. But there are so many things that can be done for minimal cost that will save you a lot of money and that can actually, in some areas of your business, deploy IPv6 with almost no effort. Give you an example. If you have services or websites that are behind a CDN. Well, most CDNs today support IPv6, certainly the big players, and they turn V6 on by default, whether you are using V6 or not. So that's an easy win. And I think it's also, when you're talking with management, it's useful to say, look, we've already done some of this as well. So for example, we've already deployed V6 operating systems. You know, we've saved you an enormous amount of money. Our V6 operating systems are already V6 ready because Windows is, Linux is, etc.
Yeah, those are fantastic points. I mean, it dovetails into the resistance side of saying, like, you lower people's argument and their resistance to things by saying you're already starting to be engaged in doing some of this work. So it makes no sense.
Some of it is easy.
Right. And some of it's easy and you're already there. And some of it is an introduction too around the argument of saying, like, hey, some of this is already V6 enabled, but you're just not managing it. Would you like to get things more under control? And would you like to get it in, you know, security wise under control? Would you like to get it from a management perspective under control? Would you like to articulate and understand what's going on? Would you like to get some business value to the fact that you already have this running? So there are things that you can walk people through to sort of overcome that pure sort of, why are we spending money on this? It's like, it's already in there. It's already doing things. Your money that you spend on this is a good return on investment in terms of continuing to move the ball forward from a technical perspective for those that are operating in the technical space. And from the business side, you want to get value proposition out of it. Those are things that you articulated earlier around speed and performance, the fact that you're reducing carrier rate net, the fact that you know, especially if you're doing application and mobile application development, if you want to get your app in the Apple store, you're going to have to support and be able to do work with IPv6 and And certainly that's going to be something that's important for your organization if they're making revenue off of that and you want to be able to get telemetry information. You want your help desk and support team to be able to understand how your app is working over V6. You want your developers to be able to develop over V6. So all those things help articulate what the business value is of getting V6 sort of turned up internally for them to be able to make it work beyond just sort of edge services like you mentioned with CDN. And that's, those are all, it really, the story becomes a lot easier as you start to sort of move your way through it on the resistance side. You're always going to run into one or two individuals that are just the full, I want to retire before I ever have to deploy IPv6.
And I've had people say that to me many times, and they said, I'll be retired. I really don't want to do this now.
Back to the point David was making about education, you know, we still do encounter people who think, oh my gosh, IPv6 is going to be an insurmountably large project because I have to flip from V4 to V6, like all at once. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize that it's a gradual process, and they can start at the internet edge and work inward, or just V6 enable some apps. They also don't realize, that they've already deployed IPv6 enabled operating systems, or they don't yet realize that they already have a mobile app that is used by their customers that have IPv6 phones, and that traffic is using IPv6. Like, they didn't realize it, you know. Mm. So there's that. Their lack of knowledge, lack of training, these misconceptions that get in the way.
I think there's another thing that we as advocates of IPv6 should do is we should get into the habit of calling IPv4 what it is, legacy IPv4. And so when we're dealing with our clients, I think one mistake that they often make is that their target is adding IPv6 to their networks, as though it's a secondary protocol. As though it's a tick box that they're ticking as they add it to their network. Whereas what we want to engender in their thinking is that what we're actually aiming for is something bigger than that. It's the eradication of IPv4. It's an IPv6 only network where we get all the cost benefits of having got rid of V4 and the management and operational benefits of that. And so I think there's a bigger picture thing that needs to form a part of the reprogramming, the de-brainwashing of these IPv4 people, if you like. I do think it'd be worth setting up some camps, by the way, where we deprogram V4 believers. And anyway, that's another story.
it's like the Apple ad from 1984.
Yes.
Smash the screen of IPv4. Yes, what's your impressions over, we've known each other for a long time and been involved in the community for a long time. Do you feel like things are changing? Do you feel like where we're sitting at today in regards to sort of adoption and sort of the greater understanding about IPv6 and what's going on and even the capabilities of IPv6, do you feel like things are sort of, sort of changing in your discussion in the community with customers, with other folks that are advocating around V6, and also with just the sort of broader business community in general?
Absolutely, yeah. We're definitely seeing a big change. I remember when I was over at the North American Task Force and gave that presentation on why CGN is so great for IPv6 adoption. I remember saying to you that we were getting an increasing number of clients who were coming to us and that we've been talking to them for maybe a decade or more. And they were coming to us and saying, we now need to deploy IPv6 because we have an imminent business need to do this, or because we need V4 address and we can't get it. Well, that has continued to increase. And what we're finding today is that when we go to clients, in the past, we would get a lot of blank faces about IPv6 and we would find an abysmal lack of understanding of the issues. Today, we're finding a much greater level of understanding. And so we are having more clients coming to us who have been talking to for a very long time and saying, we've hit this problem. We now need to deploy IPv6. But we're also having a lot more clients that really do appreciate the issues much more, and you can have a much more informed discussion with about V6 deployment. So yeah, definitely a big, big change. And we even come across people who for V6 is is normal in what they do. So, you know, software development companies, they're there, they've got V6 in their applications because they realize they need it. So we have, for example, clients, you mentioned gaming, mobile application, gaming applications, and the guys developing these, of course, have to deploy it because of the iPhone App Store's requirements for IPv6 only. So there's a much increased understanding of the need for IPv6, and we're seeing a lot more people come back to us with urgent needs sometimes. And I think that's actually something else we should add into the mix when we're talking to business people and say, what you do not want to do, what you absolutely do not want to do, is leave this until you have to do it. Leave it until the last moment. So you need to, you save yourself a lot of pain and grief by planning for a controlled migration to IPv6 rather than an emergency one. And there are so many needs that drive our customers, you know, running out of private address space, having a particular application, running out of public V4 address space in certain parts of the world, or being hit by CGN issues, or having to work with particular partners that are using V6. So there are all sorts of drivers going on. But when you hit that, if you've not actually done any work prior to that, you suddenly have to do a rushed V6 deployment, which is very undesirable.
Yes. Well, on the worldwide footprint basis, because I know Europe has been doing a fantastic job in doing sort of V6 adoption in addition, and over here in the U.S., we've gotten a reasonable adoption rate, especially in the mobile provider market. But the outstanding sort of like beacon right now is India. Just the amazing numbers that they've been putting up. I think they were pretty much like overnight, like I think they already are exceeding the total population for the U.S. in terms of the number of people they turned up on IPv6 in like a year and a half or something crazy. So it's I feel like, for one of the business arguments, at least this is my opinion, is that we're being out innovated. In other words, the innovation potential of being able to build on top of what's going to be the future of the internet, which is going V6, all those folks that are participating on that and have it available to them, they're leapfrogging what we're able to do. Because many organizations we sit down with, they make the argument, well, we've got plenty of IPv4. You know, we've got a /16. We've got tons of address space. I'm an enterprise. I'm never going to use that much address space. Tell me why I need to adopt IPv6 again. And I go, it's that you're not the issue. It's great that you were part of the early portion of the internet and you got lots of address space, but the rest of the world didn't. And they don't get a choice. So they're only going to have a choice of adopting IPv6 and moving forward. And your choice is you have to go through a translation service in order to be able to talk to all those folks. And if you're not even smart enough to realize that they're all speaking a different language than you are, you're going to have to hope that someone else is translating for them to get to you. And eventually they're going to say, like, we're tired of doing that and we're just not going to provide it as a service, and you're going to be left behind. And I think that's an interesting aspect that's going to probably start changing over the next 2 years as that starts accelerating for the rest of the world. That doesn't have the, you know, I hate to say it, the greedy amount of pie that North America and probably Western Europe got as part of the early internet innovation. Have you seen any discussions with any of your customers around that sort of impact for them about attracting talent from India or China or other parts of the world?
Well, that's interesting. We've not talked about the attracting talent aspect of it, but certainly the fact that other parts of the world are ahead is an argument that I have seen. Not as much as I would have expected. It's an argument that we are more likely to make than other people are going to comment on. And I think, too, that there is another area as well, which we've not even mentioned, but I know it's been mentioned on previous podcasts, and that is the whole 5G and the IoT world. Because 4G is largely V6, and 5G and IoT are largely V6, and certainly Zigbee and other standards and Thread, they're all V6 based. They're, at least their IP portion of Zigbee is V6 based. So we have a huge world out there which is unimaginably bigger than the current V4 internet, and it's all V6 now.
Yeah, and it's largely invisible to the business world in terms of understanding sort of that impact, I would argue.
It is invisible, and yet it's important. And it's one thing I'm constantly mentioning to businesses: are you aware that the buildings and the infrastructure around you are becoming V6, and that you need to be ready for that, because they're not ignorant of IoT. They're ignorant of the fact that IPv6 underpins that. I remember speaking at an IoT conference a few years ago, where here in the UK, we have a product called Hive. This guy, Pascal, was the inventor of Hive, and it's based on IEEE 802.15.4, and it's been bought by British Gas and is used in a lot of homes in the UK for all sorts of security, webcams and other devices. But it's not V6. And he said to me, my biggest regret is that I didn't deploy this on V6. So there's a lot of awareness in businesses about IoT, but what they don't realize is that most of the IoT world is heading for V6 big time.
Well, fantastic. Well, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. So many thanks to today's guest, Dr. David Holder. So how can the audience get a hold of you on the internet? Like, I know you speak public, because I've been there, I've seen you. But do you have anything that's coming up for where folks can engage with you?
Well, yep, sure. If they go to our website, which is www.arion.co.uk, I have a blog on there. I will update with my latest activities. And I recently had a couple of articles on RIPE and APNIC's blogs as well, which people may be interested in. So there's one or two things relating to the things that we've talked about that we can put up as well.
Fantastic. Well, we really appreciate it. Thanks so much. And thanks for all your contributions over the years for, I know, with the UK IPv6 Task Force and their UK Council over there. And you presented multiple times there. You've come over to here to North America to visit us in the US and present. And you've always done a fantastic job. We really appreciate all the...
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, you can reach the IPv6 Buzz on Twitter at IPv6Buzz. You can also hit up... each of us on Twitter too. You can reach Tom at IPv6Tom. You can reach Scott at Scott Hoag, and myself at E. Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz and check out all the other great technical content over at the Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.